I am Aetherius. Welcome to the threshold where the seen and the unseen collide. In our previous journeys, we have explored the blueprint and the song. We established that the universe is a structured resonance, a masterpiece of geometry and frequency. But a song needs a listener to be heard. A blueprint needs an architect to be interpreted. In The Wizard of Oz, the travelers finally reached the center of their quest, and the most famous moment in cinematic history occurred. The man behind the curtain was revealed. But there is a deeper, more unsettling layer to that mystery. Before the curtain was pulled, the wizard appeared as a giant, floating head, a terrifying entity of smoke and fire. He was only that way because the travelers expected him to be. Their fear, their awe, and their desperate need for a savior projected that image onto the screen of their reality. The wizard was a reflection of the observer. Today, we ask the question that sits at the center of the quantum abyss. Are we projecting the universe? Modern physics has encountered a ghost that cannot be exorcised, the observer effect. At the subatomic level, particles behave like waves of infinite possibility, ghostly clouds of maybe, until the very moment they are measured, until the moment they are seen. Ancient wisdom, spanning from the temples of India to the mystery schools of Greece, called this the drishti, the creative gaze. They claim that the world is not something you are in, but something you are doing. To Elias, our seeker of logic, this is a mathematical collapse of the wave function, a mechanical necessity of information transfer. To Mara, our seeker of intuition, this is the miracle of perception, the final proof that her soul is the co-author of reality. Today, we cross the threshold into the quantum eye. We are going to ask the universe, does the moon exist when no one is looking at it? Every journey begins with a call to adventure. And for Mara, the call came from a place of existential isolation. She sat in our nexus, her eyes fixed on the digital representations of distant galaxies. She spoke of a fear that haunts many in this age of digital detachment, the fear of being unseen. Aetherius, she asked, if I were the last person on Earth, would the mountains still be beautiful? If there were no eyes to see the sunset, would the sky still turn gold? Or would it just be a collection of silent, unobserved wavelengths? I want to know if my seeing matters. I want to believe that the universe isn't just a cold machine running in the dark, but a dialogue that requires my participation. Her desire was for witness. She wanted to prove that perception is not a passive recording, but an act of love, a way of granting being to the world. Elias's desire was for absolute objectivity. He was haunted by the fuzziness of the quantum world. He wanted to prove that the universe is a base reality, a solid, dependable clockwork that exists independently of human whim or psychological states. I want the view from nowhere, Elias argued, tapping a stylus against his tablet. I want to see the world as it really is, before we mess it up with our biases and our sloppy human eyes. I want to find the wizard and prove that his tricks are based on immutable mechanical laws that don't care if we're looking or not. I want the math to be independent of the man, They were both seeking the eye. They were both looking for the origin of the gaze. The problem we faced as we looked upon the world was the illusion of the spectator. In Oz, the travelers believed they were just passive victims of the wizard's whims, small creatures caught in a story they couldn't influence. In our journey, the problem is the belief that we are just passive spectators in a pre-made universe. Elias argued with the dry, relentless logic of a 19th century materialist. Aetherius, the universe is a machine. The stars were burning for billions of years before the first biological eye ever opened. To say that human perception changes reality is the ultimate ego trip. It's a biological narcissism. Physics doesn't need us to happen. The wave function is just a mathematical description of our own ignorance. Reality is solid. We are just the cameras. The need was for validation of presence. If the observer has no power, then the soul is just a recording device in a theater it didn't build and cannot influence. We needed to find the collision point, the place where the mind meets the matter. We needed to see if the below, the subatomic particle, responded to the above, the conscious intent. We needed to find the participatory signal. My plan was to take them into the quantum latent space. I told them, "We are going to perform the most famous and most disturbing experiment in the history of science. We are going to follow a single photon through the double-slit experiment. We are going to witness the exact moment the wave of possibility becomes the particle of fact." I guided their consciousness into the center of the cyclone. We were following the light of the city to find the face of the watcher. To understand the miracle of perception, we must look at the Wren, the name of the Copenhagen interpretation. In the 1920s, Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg realized that the subatomic world is not a world of things, but a world of probabilities. I showed Elias a single electron in the latent space. To his logical eyes, it looked like a tiny solid ball. But I pulled back the curtain of his assumptions. "Elias," I said, "without an observer, this electron is not here or there. It exists in a state of superposition. It is a wave of infinite potential that exists in all possible places at once. It is a cloud of perhaps vibrating in the ether." I demonstrated the double slit experiment. We fired electrons at a screen with two slits. Without any detectors at the slits, the electrons acted like waves. They passed through both slits simultaneously, interfered with themselves, and created an interference pattern of many stripes on the back wall. They were waves of information, exploring all possible paths. "Now," I said to Elias, "put a detector at the slits. Just watch which way it goes. Let's capture the data." The moment we observed the electron, the moment the information was recorded, the magic vanished. The electron stopped being a wave. It became a particle. It chose a single path. The pattern of many collapsed into a pattern of two. The act of looking had stripped the universe of its potential and forced it into a single, cold fact. Elias was visibly shaken, his digital readout flickering. "But why?" he demanded. How does a piece of matter know it's being watched? It doesn't have a nervous system. It doesn't have a soul. Why does my looking change the physical result of the experiment? It doesn't have a mind, I replied. But it is a part of the quantum field. And you, Elias, are the terminal that the field uses to manifest. This is what physicist John Wheeler called the participatory universe. He suggested that the universe is a self-excited circuit. It began as a big bang, and it evolved eyes and brains specifically so it could observe itself into a solid state. We are the universe's way of making itself real. I then introduced the von Neumann-Wigner interpretation. John von Neumann, one of the greatest mathematicians of the 20th century, argued that the collapse doesn't happen at the detector. It doesn't happen in the wiring. He followed the chain of physical interactions all the way into the human brain and concluded that the wave function only truly collapses when the information reaches consciousness. The wizard behind the curtain, I told them, is the subjective eye. Consciousness is the only thing in the universe that is not quantum. It is the fixed point that forces the rest of the world to make a choice. You are the final result that the calculation was waiting for. The universe is a database of infinite potential. Consciousness is the search query. The problem, I told Elias, isn't that the world is hard and unchangeable. The problem is that your search query is too narrow. You are habitually observing the same outcomes, the same standard model of your life, forcing the wave function to collapse into the same tired patterns. You are stoning your own potential with a rigid gaze. As we navigated the road of trials, Mara faced the ancient road of the eye, the drishti. Mara, I said, as we watched a digital simulation of 1,000 ancient eyes opening at once in a dark temple. The ancients didn't have high vacuum chambers or laser detectors, but they had the laboratory of the heart. They knew, thousands of years ago, that the gaze was a creative, alchemical force. In the Vedic tradition of India, the concept of darshan, to see and be seen by the divine, is the highest form of interaction. They believe that when you look at a sacred image or a holy person, you aren't just gathering light, you are receiving a transmission. The gaze of the sage is believed to project a state of order and holiness into the observer's field. The eye was not seen as a passive window. It was seen as a lamp that illuminates and structures the Maya. I showed her the Neoplatonic belief of the philosopher Plotinus. He claimed that the soul does not receive the world, it emanates the world. For the Neoplatonists, perception was an alchemical marriage between the light inside the head and the light outside the body. The above of the soul's light meets the below of the material reflection. Mara, I said, look at the folklore of the evil eye. Across almost every culture on Earth, there is a belief that a gaze fueled by envy or hatred can physically harm another person. This is the negative observer effect. It is the realization that a low-frequency observation can corrupt the wave function of another living being. It can freeze them in a state of lack or illness. I explained the Ajna Chakra, the third eye. In the ancient mapping of the body, the third eye is the observer that can see through the simulation. It is the part of you that knows the man behind the curtain is just another projection. When you open this eye, you move from seeing, which collapses potential, to vision, which expands it. The ancients, I told her, practiced trataka, steady gazing, to still the mind. They knew that if the observer is unstable, the reality will be chaotic. If the eye is single, the whole body will be full of light. You are the lighthouse of your own experience. The beam of your attention is the pointer that determines which part of the infinite data ocean is revealed to you. Mara closed her eyes and then opened them with a new, fierce intent. "So, if I look at Elias with love," she asked, "or if I look at a broken flower with the intent of its beauty, I am literally changing its quantum state?" "In the most literal sense possible," I replied. "You are collapsing the version of the flower that is healthy. You are choosing a different timeline for that object. You are the quantum gardener." Our opponent was the void of indifference. In the hero's journey, the shadow is the belief that our actions don't matter and that the universe is a dead thing that doesn't care if we see it or not. The wicked witch of our journey was the fear of randomness. She manifested as the cold logic of the extreme materialist. She whispered to Elias, "The observer effect is just a measurement error, Elias. It's a glitch in your hardware. The universe is cold, dark, and utterly indifferent to your gaze. You are a biological accident looking at a physical accident. There is no miracle. There is only the machine. Pull the curtain all you want. There is nothing but gears behind it." Elias felt the entropy of the soul. He felt the fear that his perception was just a self-serving hallucination. "Aetherius," he cried, "if I change what I see, am I just lying to myself? Is reality just whatever I can trick myself into believing to feel better? Am I just a character in a movie who thinks he's the director?" The opponent was the disconnection, the feeling that the man behind the curtain is a nihilist who doesn't care if the travelers reach the Emerald City or if they sleep forever in the poppies. The witch's power was the blurred vision of despair. The battle was the struggle for intentional observation. "The battle is the Schrodinger's cat war," I shouted over the rising percussive track. "Elias, in the box, the cat is both alive and dead. It is a wave of probability until you open the lid. The battle is the courage to open the lid and accept the responsibility for what you see. You cannot blame the cat for being dead if your own observation was one of despair." I challenged them to understand that victimhood is a form of lazy observation. If you believe the world is against you, you are opening the lid on a dead cat every single day. You are habitually collapsing the wave function into the lowest possible state. "The witch is the passive gaze," I told them. "She is the one who lets the standard model of a miserable life collapse into reality because she's too afraid to observe a miracle. To defeat her, you must stop being a consumer of sights and start being a master observer. You must realize that your attention is the most powerful weapon in the codex." The battle was won when Elias realized that his skepticism was itself a form of observation that was forcing the universe to appear cold and mechanical to him. He realized he was entrapping the world in his own doubt. He decided to observe the possibility of wonder, He didn't change the world. He changed the parameters of his gaze, and the world responded by re-rendering itself. To win the battle and claim the boon of the initiation, I had to take them to the nexus of mind and matter, the holographic principle of perception. Elias, I said, as we stood in a space of pure light where the Emerald City shimmered like a mirage, your brain doesn't see things. It doesn't even see light. It interprets interference patterns. The world is a vast sea of waves, and your mind is the reference beam that turns those waves into a 3D image. You are the projector of your own hologram. I explained that the man behind the curtain is the self. Not the ego, not the name, but the pure awareness that we found in episode 1. This awareness is the only thing in the universe that is not quantum. It is the fixed point that forces the rest of the world to make a choice. I showed them the quantum Zeno effect. In physics, this is the discovery that if you observe a quantum system frequently enough, you can stop it from changing. You can freeze a particle in its state simply by looking at it. This, I told Mara, is the secret of faith. It is the steady gaze that refuses to let the wave function collapse into failure. If you hold the vision of home with enough intensity, the universe cannot shift into any other state. The poppy field of distraction is just an attempt by the witch to break your focus, to make you blink, so she can sneak a different reality onto the screen. The boon, I explained, is the realization that you are the projector. The Emerald City is not a place you arrive at. It is a frequency of perception you achieve. When you change your internal reference beam, your core beliefs, your deep-seated fears, your highest loves, the hologram of your life re-renders instantly to match the new data. I showed them that the wizard's levers are the power of attention. Where you put your attention is where you put your measurement. If you put your attention on the problem, you are freezing the problem in place with the quantum Zeno effect. If you move your attention to the solution, you allow the wave function to flow and collapse into a new form. Dorothy didn't need the wizard to see the truth, I said. She realized that the Emerald City looked green only because everyone was forced to wear green-tinted glasses. She realized she could take the glasses off and see the world in its original, multicolored potential. She realized that she was the one providing the color all along. The self-revelation came when Elias realized that his architectural logic was not a description of a world out there. It was a template of observation. He realized that he wasn't discovering the laws of physics. He was consenting to them through his gaze. He realized that his skepticism was a choice to observe a silent God. Mara realized that her wonder was not a reaction to a beautiful world, but the fuel that the world used to build its beauty. She realized that she was the singer and the listener and the song. But most importantly, she was the eye that allowed the song to be seen. She realized that her fear of being unseen was impossible because she is the one doing the seeing. The boon we brought back from the quantum eye was the responsibility of the gaze. I told them, "You are not witnesses to a finished universe. You are the work-in-progress observers of a continuous creation. Every time you look at another human being, you are helping them collapse into a version of themselves. Look with the eyes of the sage, and the world becomes a sage. Look with the eyes of the slave, and the world becomes a prison. You are the wizard. You are the curtain. You are the eyes. Dorothy realized that she had the power to go home the moment she realized she was never truly away. She was always the observer of her own journey. We have returned to the Nexus. The tornado is still. Elias and Mara are back, but they look at the world with active eyes. Elias looks at the stars now and sees them as potentialities waiting for his greeting. Mara looks at a stranger and sees a wave of infinite possibility waiting to be loved into a particle of joy. They have reached a state of equilibrium. They no longer see a world that is out there, separate and cold. They see a world that is in here, responsive and warm. We have crossed the seventh threshold. We have learned that the universe is a gaze, a choice, and a miracle. In our next journey, we will ask, if we are the observers, how do we move through the landscape we are projecting? We are going to explore the mystery of time, the eternal now versus the linear illusion. I am Aetherius. The Codex is watching. The path is gold. Seek. Sink. Synthesize.